Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Geron Technologies podcast. We are recording from Google for Startups Campus, Google's home for startups. Campus offers startups the opportunity to gain access to Google products, connections, and best practices, as well as programming and events for startups. We are now in their Creator Studio, a state-of-the-art video and podcast room available for startups for free. For more info on all things Campus, check out their website, www.campus.co/Tel Aviv. I'm Karen Etkin, and I'm here with Cecile Belilios, founder and managing partner of Impact First Investments. Hi, Cecile.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me here.
I know you're a bit under the weather today, so I really, really appreciate you getting in traffic and coming here today.
Well, I'm happy to be here. I just hope I won't sound like too stuffed.
I'm sure it's fine. So can you tell us a little bit about Impact First? It's an investment company. How does that happen? What does that look like?
Sure. So Impact First Investments was founded it in 2011 with the notion that technology and impact must go together if we want to address challenges, the biggest challenges that our society and our planet is facing, then technology has to be a catalyst. And having worked in impact investing before, I thought that Israel could be a really serious hub in creating social impact with its technology abilities. And with that notion, I founded Impact First, thinking that let's be Israel-centric in terms of finding the right technologies, which by definition always look forward to global markets. No Israeli startup really focuses on the Israeli market, but instead looks at the global markets and think about how these technologies can really do something positive and impact the world positively.
And how did you get into impact in the first place?
So I was really very lucky because I was an entrepreneur and founder and manager of startups and worked with a Dutch family foundation of a family called BAN, the Nobel Foundation in the Netherlands. And they happened to be one of the first movers of the whole impact movement. Of course, we didn't know that at the time. We just thought right after the dot-com bubble burst in 2000, 2001, that there must be a reconnection between capital, values, and technology. And with that notion, started thinking about how to make investments in startups that would do something positive for the world in a profitable manner. And that's all we had in terms of our thoughts. So I was really very lucky to be in the room, literally, thinking about what does it mean to have an impact? What is the negative impact? How do you measure impact? Why should you measure impact? All these questions that you can now just Google and get some answers to. So we had to invent these things. And that was very, very exciting. And we really invented this new thing that eventually took off and became what is now called impact investing. We called it venture philanthropy, social venturing, all kinds of names. The fourth sector, all kinds of things came up and some didn't stay. But eventually, these were really the very early signs of blending capital and values and thinking about how technology can really create both of them. So I had the best training in the world in plowing a field that was like totally virgin. And had the best mentors. So here I am.
Cool. And you got to do this, all of this in Israel?
Yes. So I've been with the foundation for many, many years. And I represented them in Israel. I managed their portfolio, investment portfolio in Israel. But I was also involved in all the processes that happened in the actual global foundation. And when I decided to focus on Israel with Impact First Investments, I thought that Israel has a lot more to offer. The foundation was focusing on only two themes, and I thought that actually any technology for anything that would do positive impact should be included, and that there was no home for social startups in Israel. So I said, okay, so I will be the home for social startups in Israel.
So Impact First is actually the first investment company that invests in startups that are making a positive impact on society in Israel.
Yes, that's correct.
And it started in what year?
In 2011.
2011. So before impact was even a thing in
Israel.
No,
actually, well, impact investing, the term itself was minted in 2007 and 2008. So people started talking about it. A lot of people still talk about it without really understanding the definitions, etc. And I think that now it's really become something that is like in the center of every conversation of investors and entrepreneurs. And there's still a lot of confusion and a lot of some social washing. So, you know, like you had greenwashing before. I guess that happens too. But basically, people are getting that there has to be more than just profit to a corporate. And people are thinking very seriously about the stakeholder value. Just last month, the 200 CEOs of the major companies in the US talked about how corporates should be looking at stakeholder value, not only shareholder value. The CEO of BlackRock has been talking about stakeholders and impact for a long time. All the major financial institutions have massively invested in impact. So there's definitely something going on, and it's growing exponentially. But when we started it in 2011 in Israel, nobody knew what that was about.
And you had to like go and explain to people what impact is?
I still do. but yes, I had to explain to people on both sides of the financial equilibrium. So for people that are from the business side, investors and entrepreneurs, I had to explain that you actually don't have to compromise on your profit if you want to maximize your impact. When you're in the technology sector, there's no reason why there should be a compromise, or it should be either or. I'm for the end methodology, which means the more you sell, the more your company is successful, the more impact you make. And that's on the financial side. So there's still a lot of suspicion by investors thinking that if you're making something that has an impact, that is embedded into its business, and the company talks about it and measures it, then you must be giving away something and you're not going to maximize profit. So I have to explain that to the financial investors. And on the other hand, people from the philanthropy sector are very concerned that we're going to be taking away all their donation capital because money is going to be flowing into these kinds of companies instead of going to social causes, which in a way is partly true. It's not 100% true. There's still going to be a lot of money invested or donated into philanthropy, but some of it is going to go into social businesses and entities that are trying to achieve solutions for social and environmental challenges by using the business practices and not nonprofits.
Do you think that is because people want to see some return for their money, or because they want to see the impact measured, which sometimes nonprofits don't do?
So first of all, the whole idea of measuring your impact is something that is terribly important for anyone, particularly for the nonprofit sector. And that was not the practice. When the impact investing domain started really sprouting, one of the reasons it's happened was because on the nonprofit side, there was a lot of criticism on how the nonprofits are being managed, with lack of transparency and lack of accountability and a really unknown amount of impact that they were making. And on the other hand, there was a lot of criticism on the business side, saying you cannot just be capitalistic pigs and think about your returns and your maximization of shareholder value, because when you do that, then you're by definition going to be hurting society and the planet. So those two notions have created this middle ground where people started saying the capitalistic method of setting up corporates that are there to maximize profits is fine, but the maximization of profits should consider the society, it should consider the environment, it should consider stakeholders, and it should be run in an ethical way. So it should think about inclusion and diversity. It should think about age. It should think about anything that that is not like what was then thought of as the business of business is business. So actually, the business of business has to be a business that is also serving its society, its community, and its planet.
So we're making progress.
I think so. So first of all, the impact investing domain in 2018 was at more than $500 billion, and that is growing by 100% year over year. So that's really massive.
Wow.
So it's a big deal. In Israel, we're still very much behind, but I think that Israel's aptitude to develop technology for solutions for anything will really make Israel jump to the head of the pack, in the sense that once the idea that you can make a positive impact on society, on the planet, etc., and you don't have to compromise your profits, once that is accepted in the mainstream, then a lot of companies are going to be speaking about their impact, measuring their impact, and thinking about how to do more of that, because they understand that this is going to be drawing the talent that they want to draw, keep the good people in the companies, support their brand, and bring new investment capital that was not available to them before. So all in all, it's going to really bring a lot of good things to the company. So once we take away the suspicion that is still there by investors and by founders of startups that if you're doing something good, you might not be maximizing profits. Once we take that off the table, then it's just going to take off and Israel will be a leader in developing tech for impact.
What do you think should happen for us to make that final leap?
So a lot of things. One is that mainstream investors will have to start adopting the idea that you can do the end theory. So profit and purpose and not instead of. That is already happening. So one of my partners in Impact First Investments is Pitango Venture Capital. It's Israel's largest venture fund that manages more than $2 billion. And they have now decided to start adopting the methodologies of impact into their screening process. So one thing that we're going to do together is look at their existing portfolio companies, ones that can be migrated into creating impact. So it's not only about making the actual impact, but it's also about saying what is the intended impact, measuring the risks, measuring the negative, potential negative impact, and then tracking the net impact that these companies are doing and bringing that to the forefront, and also applying that to new screening of companies in the sense that first you look at the ESG, so the environment, social and governance, so you look at diversity, you look at inclusion, all these things have to be built into the corporate DNA, your carbon footprint, all kinds of things that are currently very important and very widespread. And more than that, for the companies who can address social or environmental challenges with their product, then to embed that into their products. And that, I think, is the first step. So that's very, a very courageous and very important move that Pitango is taking, to look at the market of startups in Israel and say, okay, we have more than 6,000 startups in Israel at any given moment. About a third of them are addressing some of the sustainable development goals, so the 17 goals that the UN has declared that must be addressed by 2030 if we want to have an equitable society and a good planet to live in. So why not think about the impact that these companies are making and embed that into our practices? So mainstreaming it is one thing. And that will also reduce the suspicion level of the investors. The other thing that has to happen is that entrepreneurs, who many of them do want to make a lot of positive impact, sometimes they just don't know how to verbalize it. Sometimes they know, but they're afraid to mention it because they're afraid that they're not going to get funded because they say it. And sometimes you just want help in somebody who's a professional in measuring it in a professional way that is non-biased and can really help them track the impact that they're making. So it's an important thing. So I think on the entrepreneur side, we're going to have to bring more education to people in companies and startups that work across the board in any position about how they make or they blend the impact that they can make with what the company produces. So I think mainstreaming it is going to make a big difference. Of course, the government has a lot to do with it. Israel has a very strong support, governmental support to startups. And already it has four different tracks with the Innovation Authority that are supporting impact. So that has to grow because impact startups still have a disadvantage. So they need to be addressed by bridging that gap through governmental funding. And at the end of the day, it's going to be about the institutional investors who carry the biggest chunks of capital to go into impact investing as part of their portfolio.
Great. I'm looking forward to when that will happen.
Me too.
Can we talk a little bit about your investment strategy? What are you looking for in companies that you might want to fund?
Sure. So Impact First is not a fund. We're an investment company. That means actually that we're serving individuals and family offices who want to make these kinds of investments. So they're looking for deal flow that blends technology with impact that could be measured, but that maximize profits. Because impact investors have a tendency, or in particular, private impact investors, they have a tendency to be either a thematic or with a particular liking to a certain type of investments. And they have different risk return profiles and risk appetite. So we can accommodate all of them. Our investors can actually choose the companies that they can invest in and then build their own portfolio. So for us to fund a company, so far we've funded early stage companies. And that has been, among others, because one of our investors is willing to take more risks. So we can, with him, go to earlier stage companies, which are more risky, and allow that capital to flow into these companies. So our investment strategy is very simple. We're looking for the best entrepreneurs that have a clear vision of a problem, which is an environmental or a social problem that they want to address with a technology product that is massive enough, so it's big enough to create a good market, that they know where their market is. Sometimes it's a niche market, which many times is a good thing, and are able to deliver on the premise. Obviously, we are aware that startups don't usually end where they start, and they have to change their business models. They have to do their product market fit and understand what works more, less, and work accordingly. So we're always very flexible with them. But again, we're looking at top entrepreneurs that want to create a positive impact, that are willing to measure it together with us, and actually that adds benefits to them. They think this is beneficial, and are Israeli or Israeli related, and have access to global markets.
You have some edtech startups in your portfolio. Can you give some examples on why it made you invest specifically in those?
So aging is, it's actually extremely important, extremely interesting, because when we look at aging, many of the technologies that were at least initially thought of as suitable for the disabilities market are actually also good for the aging market. And a lot of these technologies actually treat a very wide segment of population. So, for example, we have a company called MindYou. MindYou tracks the cognitive decline of people through passive collection of the data out of the voice that they speak on their phones. It's actually, you can compare it to listening to music. So if I listen to the music of your voice and I know that this is how you sound when you're okay, I will know via the AI technology that MindYou developed when the music has changed, and that can imply that there's a cognitive decline, which can also imply that there's a physical decline. And that is very helpful to track elderly people who might suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's. But it can also help people who are discharged from the hospital and need to be tracked that there's nothing wrong that's happening to them, or people that suffer from more than one or two chronic conditions that need tracking. So that's MindYou, for example. Another company that we have is a company called AngelSense that is currently focusing on the autism market. They created a tracking and monitoring device that helps parents of autistic children track their children and understand if there's anything wrong with them, including if they get lost. That is totally relevant for the aging market. And we think that once the company is established in the disabilities market, they will also expand into the aging market, which, again, is very close in terms of product itself, but different in the business model, of course. So these are just two examples of companies that we've invested in aging.
And what separated those from the pact? Because I'm sure you get a lot of decks sent to your inbox. Like, what made those two stand out?
So a lot of time it's the quality of the entrepreneur and their experience, their ability in our eyes to carry the company all the way through. So we don't believe in changing horses in the middle. It used to be a notion that you could invest in a company that you'll just at some point appoint a CEO and the founder will move to the side. We don't believe in that.
That's a hassle.
And it also really doesn't work very well. I mean, it does work once in a while, but it's rare. So it's better to find entrepreneurs that we believe can take the companies all the way. It's the size of the market and understanding the acuteness of the problem and the solution. And, you know, sometimes it's just timing. It's funny because a lot of entrepreneurs think that maybe a fund or an investor didn't invest in them for all kinds of reasons, like, I don't know, maybe they weren't good enough or something. Sometimes it's just timing. And if you're busy making two deals, then maybe you're not going to make a third one right now. There's a lot of things that happen. And just so you know, we track the companies we invest in for a long time. I mean, it's never happened that a company walks through the door and, you know, a week later we've invested. It's always something that is like an evolving process. We want to see where they're going, what's the product market fit that they're looking for, what's the market saying. It's a complex process.
The due diligence of a specific company?
Yes. Plus, I have an affinity for women, so I want to promote women founders and women entrepreneurs. And just as an example, the MindYou CEO and founder is a woman, Ruth.
And they're doing really, really well.
I'm very proud of them.
You've been part of the tech industry for many years, and you've worked with people who are based all over the world. Are there any characteristics to the Israeli ecosystem that make it unique in your eyes?
Generally speaking?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Israel really does have a culture of entrepreneurship. We're really not afraid to fail. This is part of our process. And a lot of people ask me when I travel, can Israel teach other countries to be more entrepreneurial? And we do that a lot. I think there's a lot going on in terms of transferring of methodologies, etc. But when you come from a culture where failure is regarded as like a disaster, people are not going to take risks. So that's something very, very present in Israel. People are audacious, they are courageous, and they are willing to put themselves on the spot and go all in and set up a company, even if, you know, a few months later or a few years later, it will have failed. Never mind, their next venture is probably going to be even better. So that's one thing. Number two, it's what I call the curse and the blessing of the Israeli market size. Companies that are being started in Israel can never look at Israel as their final market. I mean, they can look at it as a beta testing, or of course the Israeli market needs to be served as well, but this is never like the total intent, which is the curse, because it forces you to think about global markets from day one. How do you approach them? How do you choose the right market? How do you think about your product market fit in that particular market? It's overseas, it's complicated, it's costly. But that's also the blessing, because that means that from day one, you're an international company, which in a lot of other countries doesn't happen. A lot of times, companies that are based in Germany or in France or in Brazil, so first of all, they serve their own markets. And then when they need to expand and grow beyond that market, that's when it's really hard for them. So Israel doesn't have that problem. Everybody thinks about global markets from day one. I also think that the talent here is quite remarkable. Obviously, the army is producing a lot of knowledge, and talented people go through the system, the army system, and come out both talented and knowledgeable, which is great. I think the prices here are still lower than they are in other countries. So if you invest in a US startup, it's going to be more expensive than investing in an Israeli startup. That's why the R&D usually stays here in Israel. So all in all, I think Israel has that secret sauce, if you will. But we're not going to keep it for long if we don't pay attention. So first of all, a lot of people are really learning of that. And the younger generation are looking at global markets and thinking, how do people in Israel, for example, or in Silicon Valley succeed? And they're copying it. So that's not going to be for us forever. And number two, we really need to tap into new people that can join that market. If we don't do that, then the Israeli market is going to, or the high-tech market is going to just keep being a very closed environment that only serves like 8 or 10% of the population. So we must bring in many more women. We must bring in people from all ages, people from the Arab community, people from the ultra-Orthodox community. Everybody has to be participating in the high-tech sector. And that will really create a strength, and the diversity will bring us strength that no one else has. So we have to keep the advantage going. And that's, we need to work at that.
For sure. So to keep a competitive edge, we need to have more diversity and inclusion.
Yes.
What's your take on the HTEC market? There are opportunities, obviously, in this market because it's very much a blue ocean. What do you see? What are the opportunities are, in your opinion?
So, first of all, the size of the market, it's huge, and it's very diverse. If you think about baby boomers that are just retiring, and you think about people that are over 80, that's a different market, but they're still like looked at as one market. But actually, these are very different market segments. I think they're just by thinking about the sheer numbers of people who are aging on one hand and younger people who can take care of them on the other hand, there's a gap. And the gap is going to just keep widening all the time. So the result is going to be that we'll have to think of a different solution to bridge that gap and take care of these people that are aging. So technology is the only thing that can really help bridge that gap. So that's where the massive opportunity is. Having said that, it's still a very, very conservative market. It's a market that is difficult to penetrate. Sometimes it doesn't have any money. So in many cases, people are thinking about traveling for people who are retired. That's all very nice. And these are just, you know, general good business practices to create travel opportunities for people that are above 65. That's great. But and these are people who do have money. But when you think about people who are bedridden or need some protection or have medical conditions, many of them don't really have the ability to pay, which creates a challenge for startups that need to be paid for their product. So somebody needs to pay. So, and the structures are still not there. If you look at the US market, for example, then there really is no structure. I mean, it's not like the government is going to step in and pay for products or services. So the business challenges are still very, very big. I think the product opportunities are massive. The need is certainly there, but the business models are still challenging.
Of course. Where do you see this market in 5 to 10 years?
Oh, it's going to just grow and grow. I mean, look, it's just sheer numbers. The even more so if you look at the East. Look at China, for example. Like these are really massively growing markets where you have less and less young people and more older people, and just something needs to give. That there's really no other way that we can take care of our elderly unless we use tech solutions. So that's it's a one direction thing. It's the question is, what are we going to do about?
Well, hopefully we'll have lots of startups coming up with great solutions and we'll solve everything.
Yeah, well, again, I think the startups are there and they will come more and more if the business issues are going to be solved. We're still stuck with the business models.
Well, I think that insurers and governments are sort of realizing that there are problems and they are taking steps to like meet startups, not necessarily where they are, but somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, even the Israeli government, actually I was part of a group that was appointed by the Israeli government to think about aging and technology. And we came out, we met for several months, a large group of people, and we came out with some conclusions that we presented to the government, which talk about the inclusion of more technology solutions, the inclusion of or the import of existing technology solutions from around the world that can be implemented in Israel and set up to fit the Israeli needs. And also to look at just general technology solutions for anything and think about a way to implement them in the aging market. Because sometimes you don't need to invent something. You just need to tweak it to make it work for a particular type of people. And aging people, again, it's not just one market. But in many ways, there are existing technologies that all you need to do is just think of them in a different way and apply them in a different way that will solve issues that the elderly are facing or need to be addressed. And that can also bring a lot of content or a lot of existing and proven technologies into the aging market that didn't think that they were aging technologies before. So that's another conclusion that we draw, that you drew. And I think this is relevant for everywhere in the world.
Yeah, for sure. So if I'm an entrepreneur and I want to get into the age tech business, or any, you know what, I'm any entrepreneur going to any business, what advice would you give me?
Well, first of all, you have to know your market. Really deeply, intimately know your market. In the AngelSense case, for example, the founder of AngelSense is the father of an autistic child, and his co-founder has a nephew who is on the spectrum. So they are the market. They understand it very deeply. They understand the problems of the market, and that's easier for them than to address them. So knowing the market will cut a lot of the costs and time that it takes for startups to take off. The technology is a critical part, but without the market, it's almost worthless. So setting up excellent technology is really great, but if you don't know where you're going with it, then this is not the right order of things. So when I see an entrepreneur, I would always recommend for them, even if you're like a tech star, a stellar entrepreneur, and you know exactly how to develop a solution for a problem, first make sure that the problem really exists and that there's a market for it and that people are willing to pay for it and how the system works, etc. So at least you know when you start where you're going. I can guarantee that you're going to change. things are going to change. But you have to start in a place where you can feel comfortable about knowing the market. Number two, being an entrepreneur is very, very hard. All the glory and, you know, these TV shows that show you like all the glory and fun that people are having as entrepreneurs. Some of it is true, obviously, but it's a lot of hard work. And, ups and downs and funding is hard. There's really a lot of hardships. So I look at entrepreneurship a little bit like running a marathon, but in sprints. So if you don't understand that you're going to have to run sprints, but actually the total run is a marathon, maybe don't go into it. It's very tough, very intense. Most of the entrepreneurs I know, maybe all of them, have a hard time balancing their personal lives with families, with their entrepreneurship. So that's something to consider. This is also, I think, one reason why women are sometimes deterred from being entrepreneurs, and that needs to be addressed, and it needs to be done in a way that the work-life integration works, so it's not only a domain that's reserved for men. And, after you know what the problem is, you relate to the market, you understand it, you're capable of delivering a solution that is a good solution that can be defended, and you have the stamina to bring it all the way, that's what you need in order to get started.
That's very good advice. Is there anything else you would like to add?
Well, you know, impact entrepreneurs are people who want to change the world for the better. So entrepreneurs want to change the world, right? They see a problem, they want to change it, and they're not people who take problems lying down. They see a reality and they don't like it, so they want to change it. And that's the nature of an entrepreneur. But to me, I have the best job in the world because all day long, all I see is entrepreneurs who are coming into my office with a social problem that they recognize, and they think about how to address it. And they really do want to save the world, and they do want us to help them think about how to do that in a comprehensive, measurable, quantitative way. So in the impact space, I think this is really one of the best benefits that people have, is that they go to work in the morning and they think, wow, you know, I'm doing something with a purpose. I'm doing something important. I highly recommend that to any entrepreneur. And I also recommend it to anyone, even if you're working, I don't know, in a bank, or you're an investor, or you're just happen to have some capital that you maybe inherited, or you work in, I don't know, Google campus, you can still make a lot of impact. Think about this as part of your DNA. When you have that, first of all, you wake up in the morning with a smile on your face. And having a purpose in your job, which is higher than just yourself and your salary, really creates a sense of achievement, I would say. So I would highly recommend to entrepreneurs and investors in particular to think about the impact that they make and how they can make a bigger impact. And I think that will lead them to look for the professionals that can help them really achieve that. And this will result in just any investment being an impact investment. I think the word impact just needs to get out of the system. Any investment should be an impact investment. Any company you set up should be there to solve a problem that people experience or the planet experiences. Any investor should think about how his capital is directed at doing something that has a meaning and a purpose. And then when we do that, we just we don't need the word impact anymore. It's just going to be mainstream investing.
I couldn't agree more. And on that note, we are done for today. Thank you so much, Cecile, for being here.
Thank you, Karen, for having me.
And have a great day.
Thank you, you too.
That's all we have for today. For more EdgeTech content, visit thegerontechnologist.com. You could also subscribe to the newsletter or follow me on LinkedIn or Twitter. Bye!